80% of executives plan to increase their budget for observability in the next year. 20% expect to increase it significantly.
This episode is sponsored by LinearB. Accelerate your development pipeline with data-driven engineering metrics, continuous improvement automation, and project visibility while cutting your software development cycle time in half. Sign up for your free demo at linearb.io and mention the DevInterrupted podcast discount for a 1 month free when you sign up for an annual pro membership.
Hey everyone, welcome to DevInterrupted. I'm your host, Dan Lines, and today we are joined by New Relic Global VP Buddy Brewer and SVP Greg Parado to talk about what's happening at New Relic and their new State of Observability report. Guys, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Dan.
Pleasure. Great to be here.
Yeah. Awesome to have you on. Now, to kick us off, Buddy, we're going to start with you. Could you take a couple of minutes to walk us through your career journey as an engineering leader? How did you become the CTO at such a great company?
Yeah, for sure. I started my career as a software engineer. I knew I wanted to do two things when I got out of school. I wanted to write software and I wanted to work at a startup. This is 20 years ago. I happened to, this was in the Triangle area in North Carolina around Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. The job that was available was in the monitoring business, and I've been doing that for the last 20 years. So it's been a lot of fun. In that time, I've worn a lot of different hats. I went from engineering. I was an engineering manager for a while, crossed over into product management, started a company in the monitoring space, sold it, worked in sales for a little while, trying to drive adoption of my company post-acquisition, led product at that company, joined New Relic. I was a general manager running our engineering and product teams for a chunk of New Relic's business. Spent a lot of time talking with a lot of our strategic customers, which is one of the great things about being at New Relic. We've got a large install base with a lot of customers doing a lot of really interesting things in software. And lately, I've been running our product partnership practice, actually, trying to connect our observability tools to all of the other tools that engineers use every day to get their work done.
That's awesome. I mean, it sounds like a pretty diverse background, not only just engineering, but some product related stuff. And you've been an entrepreneur. We're going to dive into that all a little bit later here, but it seems like that diverse background has been a key for you.
It has. I've always been interested in how things work. And I almost draw a parallel between full stack engineering and wanting to understand how all of the pieces fit together from the front end through the infrastructure and everything else in order to deliver a user experience. In the same way, I've always been fascinated by all of the pieces that have to come together and all of the teams and systems and people and everything in order to create a successful business. And so as a consequence, I've found myself in a lot of different parts of the way businesses work over the years.
Perfect. Thanks for sharing that insight. And now, Greg, I know you've been a leader not only at New Relic, but some really amazing companies as well. Hootsuite, DocuSign. What do you find unique about New Relic's culture and what led you over there?
New Relic's culture is, frankly, a standout for me. I've been fortunate to be in some really great cultures and New Relic tops the list. For me, we are very focused on our customers and their success. So you look at engineers and developers and providing them with tools to be able to do their jobs better, faster, easier, more efficiently. And for many companies, you see them slap something on the wall that says we're customer first or customer focused. And that's all it really is, just something that's been slapped on the wall. At New Relic, it truly is a mantra for everyone in the business and everything we do. And so that to me is sort of the North Star for us. And then I look at things like our values of being bold, passionate, accountable, connected, and authentic. And we're really encouraged to lean into all of those, to really bring our authentic best selves to work, to be connected to one another, to be connected to our customers and our partners, and to be bold and passionate around the things that we do in our business. And it's, again, it's not just words on a wall. It's actually walking the talk in everything that we do. And it's pretty amazing.
Do you publish the values internally? Like, is it something that all employees can reference, or how does that work?
Yeah. So we call our employees relics. We have an intranet site where all of our relics can access information around our values. But the reality is they're so integrated and woven into our day-to-day that you really don't need to go to that intranet site, whether it's in our global all hands meetings with our CEO and our executive team, or it's in communications that we see. Really, you see our values being lived and espoused and talked about on a regular basis. So it's not something that is buried on some site that you only see if you go to that. You feel it and it's lived every day.
That's awesome. Now, Greg, I know you've been a key part of developing the State of Observability Report, and we're going to get into that soon. But before we dive into that, I do want to get a little bit deeper into Buddy's background as an engineering leader and maybe get to know the leadership style there a little bit. Buddy, can you tell us about your current organizational role? You know, what does it mean to be a CTO at New Relic? How large is your team? And how do you have things organized at that level?
Right now, we are, like I said, I'm currently driving our product partnerships. And so we've built a team around creating these product partnerships with New Relic. And there are a lot of different disciplines that go into that, as you might imagine. One of them is relationship management. And so there's an alliance manager function that's involved with that, with keeping track of the 100 or so different partners that we're currently engaged with in some level or another. That broader ecosystem is really where a lot of the management comes in, is keeping all of them, finding out where everybody is at on the path of developing. Some of them are actively developing integrations into New Relic. We're actually in the process of launching some of these in the coming days that we'll be talking a lot more about soon. And then we've got some that are much more in the early stages, and they're learning about exactly what that means to be an integrated product partner of ours. Supporting all of this requires a lot of technical work. So people who build these integrations have to use our APIs. Some of those are proprietary New Relic APIs. Increasingly, because we believe the future is open telemetry for data ingest, OTLP is what we're having a lot of conversations with people about, as ways to get data on board. There are ways to build visualizations and all of this. And so there's a technical role within the team that's responsible for making sure that people are successful. And then, of course, driving awareness. Once that all comes into the platform and it's turned on, none of it means anything unless people are actually enabling these integrations and using them to solve problems. And so there's a big marketing component. But I find that with leading these partnerships, one of the biggest leadership and management challenges of that is, you know, you think about it, it's one thing to manage a team when folks are your direct reports, they report directly to you. It's another to do cross-functional leadership, but within the same company, where you're all organized around the same set of stated values and the same leadership structure and all of that. It's yet another challenge to try and get a group of people to all work together when a lot of these people are in organizations that are totally different from the one that we're working in. And yet we have to establish a set of, you know, timelines and predictability of when things are going to be available and all the rest. And so for me, just as a leader in general, not just the engineering leadership, but just all of the different dimensions of the marketing and, you know, the product management and everything else, that's been one of the most fascinating things about the role that I'm currently in.
Yeah, I mean, we can kind of see how your, I think your previous background, again, we talk about that diverse background, probably led you to even be eligible for this type of role, because there's so many disciplines here. In your current role today, how do you measure success? You talked, you're doing the partnerships and the integrations, but maybe it's not just like how many integrations. What does success look like for someone at your level?
There's qualitative and quantitative measures of success. I think both are important. The quantitative ones are things like, how many partners do we have actively integrated into our platform? When those integrations happen, how many of them are actually being picked up by our users and being installed? When they're installed, do they get installed and used, or installed and just left alone? So are there, you know, we can count monthly active users, for example. One of the big things that we found, for example, in our observability report, was that there are these massive gaps in visibility into what's going on there. People can't get all their telemetry into one place where they can reason about what's going on in their software. And so we keep track of where telemetry is coming from and how much of that telemetry is coming from all the different sources. And so we track gigabytes of telemetry from partners who, like a network partner that we launched recently, Kentik, who helps people understand what's going on in their network layer. Those are all the quantitative metrics. But at the same time, it gives us a good idea of what's getting used, how much it's getting used, and all the rest. So there's a lot of value in that. At the same time, what we're really also interested in are the stories from people. Are they solving real-world problems with those integrations? When they bring security data together with software telemetry or network data with application data or any of that stuff, are they able to do things when you bring those two sets of data together that they weren't able to accomplish otherwise?
I like that you're kind of looking at what success looks like is from a few different angles. Usually when you're at that CTO level, it can't just be one thing. I'm going to try to take you back a little bit further in your career to see if we can get a story here. I usually like to ask our guests, because our audience can learn a lot from stories. Have you ever screwed up as an engineering leader? And what did you learn from that?
Well, first of all, the question isn't have I screwed up as an engineering leader? It's which one do I want to anchor the story to?
Yeah.
I think maybe one that would be useful would be to come back to what I think might have been my first significant mistake as an engineering leader. I was a brand new engineering manager. So I'd been an individual contributor, a senior software engineer. And for the first time, I had people reporting to me. And everything started off okay. I had one rec. I was at a startup. So I did the whole thing. I wrote the listing, took the inbounds, interviewed everybody. We went with the candidate. I made the calls to all the people who we didn't go with. We didn't really have a people, ops department at my company I was at the time. And so managing one person was okay, managing two when we expanded it to. But then all of a sudden, I went from like two to about seven or eight. And the other challenge there was those first two people on my team were in the same town as me. And so we saw each other every day. The next five or six were thousands of miles away. Right. And so I was trying to manage at a bigger scale than I'd ever managed before. And I was trying to manage at a larger distance than ever before as a brand new leader. Long story short, I failed at it. And those folks were underutilized, which is one of the worst sins you can commit, by the way, especially at a startup, is having people that are underutilized. And so my management corrected that problem very quickly. It set my career as a leader back probably about a year. I got another chance later with a smaller team, and I was able to grow and avoid, thankfully, making that mistake again. But you could say that the mistake was not onboarding them correctly, not setting clear enough expectations, not, whatever. But those weren't really the mistake. Those were the consequences of the mistake. The actual mistake was that I didn't ask for help. And that not asking for help, I knew I was in trouble before everybody else found out. But I don't know what it is, if it was pride or imposter syndrome or something, whatever it was, I didn't ask for help. And that led to that big failure. And I try to anchor myself back to that all the time, because every time I've been doing things in my career, I find that I'm constantly doing new things. I always need help. And I think you'll always need help, and you have to be comfortable asking for it.
That's actually a great story. I went through a similar situation and now have, because at that time when you go from being a developer to a team leader, like the first time ever, that's one of the hardest transitions throughout an engineering career. I ended up writing a blog about my experiences, something like, hey, here's the 8 lessons that I want to share. And I'll have Connor, our producer, included in the links. But yeah, I mean, the issue in that situation, you're becoming an engineering leader and the skills that you have as a developer are not the skills that you need to be a great leader. And so I really appreciate you sharing that story. Last question in this section, if I'm looking at my notes here, buddy, you've been a co-founder and a CEO. And a lot of our listeners are, we have engineering listeners, they're building companies or they're interested in doing that someday. What advice would you give the engineering leaders who are listening about starting your own company?
I think especially, this is true for anybody, but I think it's particularly true for someone who is starting a company where you're now responsible for everything, the sales and the marketing and the product development, but you're coming from an engineering starting point. I think you have to pay particular attention to embracing no. Don't just get like used to hearing no, but actually embracing no, because you will hear it constantly everywhere you go. You'll hear it from investors. You'll hear it from customers. You'll hear it from prospective employees. And if you don't embrace no, then what happens is you avoid no and you play it safe. And if you play it safe, then you move far too slowly and you die. You have to embrace no. And no can be a good thing because, first of all, when you hear no, you have an opportunity to say, why not? And then you can learn. And learning, I think, on any team is critical to success. The teams that win are not the teams that start from the best position. It's the teams that improve the fastest. And one of the best ways to improve is to hear no and then ask why not, and then take that information on board and you can make changes, as you need to. The other thing is there's a persistence that comes along with that where eventually someone will say yes, right? And you can't get to that if you don't, hear no over and over again. So one of the things that I think it's especially true, it's an existential issue for a startup, but I think it's also true for anyone at any point in their career, even as an employee anywhere or whatever, is that you have to embrace no. And in fact, if you haven't heard no lately, then I think it means you're not aiming high enough.
amazing advice. Being one of the co-founders at Linear B, definitely something I had to learn. Hearing no often, using that no to your advantage and getting used to hearing it. And I just want to double down. I love what you were saying about it doesn't matter where you start as a team, whether you're an engineering team or you're founding your own company or you're in another department. The ability, the rate in which you can improve is actually the true measurement. And buddy, I'm really happy that you brought that to our audience's attention. So awesome stuff. Thanks for giving us some time to talk about your background, the engineering leadership and your CTO position. I really want to make sure that we have some time here to dive into the observability forecast report or the state of observability report. Greg, can you start us off by explaining to our audience a bit about what is this report?
Yeah. So, you know, we've seen observability accelerate even before the pandemic. But the reality is the importance of observability through the pandemic has become even more and more critical. And that's because as individuals, as consumers, as business people, we are relying on digital services and digital experiences more than ever, right? So whether it's us connecting through this podcast or it's online grocery shopping that we might do this evening or watching entertainment that's available online, all of those sorts of things are powered by digital experiences, which of course are underpinned by software. And we've seen an acceleration of that. So we wanted to take sort of a gauge of the market, understand the perspectives, opinions, capture some of the best practices and insights from IT leaders and executives, and even more importantly, from developers and software engineers who are in the day-to-day using products to help them plan, build, deploy, and operate great software. So really, you know, we took the opportunity to survey about 1,300 of those folks, engineers, developers, IT leaders, and execs around the world in North America, in Asia, in EMEA, Europe, the UK, France, Germany, et cetera, to really dive into and understand their perspectives on software development and observability specifically.
One of the lines that I read in the report is people are saying that observability is mission critical, but most organizations, I think, are falling short in the maturity around some of these practices that have to do with observability. What are the five key insights you think our audience should know from the report?
Yeah, I think, first of all, you mentioned that it's mission critical. In fact, 90% of the respondents said that it is strategically important to their business. And 94% of respondents said it was strategically important to their role. So in their day-to-day and what they're doing, observability really is top of mind and helping them. And in fact, executives are seeing that as well. 81% of C-suite executives said that they intend to increase their budgets for observability, with 20% expecting to do so significantly. So that's great news for engineers and developers who are using these tools every day to do better work and do their work faster and easier. But you know, you're right. We did uncover that it's not being practiced, and the maturity of that practice is not as high as you might expect. And in fact, there's engineers and developers who are having to use multiple tools to be able to get a view of their full stack, in some cases using 10 plus tools. So, and this is one of my new favorite expressions, and I learned it from Buddy, this idea of engineers and developers having to swivel chair, right? Pivot back and forth between tools just to understand all of the data that's in front of them. So that was sort of a major aha, is that the fact that it's just spread across all of these data silos and they're not able to really operate within a single platform, it has been a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate to that. Of course, what we're doing at Linear B is providing observability, essentially, starting when a developer starts code all the way out to release into production. I'm interested from the report, is there a particular area of observability? Is it I'm monitoring what's going on in production? Is it something around coding? What are the areas of observability for those that are kind of new to this?
I'll give sort of a high-level answer, and then I think I'll let Buddy dive in to more specifics. I think we're seeing predominantly observability, if you look at the entire software lifecycle of plan, build, deploy, and run or operate, most, as you might imagine, are using observability in operate, right? When stuff is in production, when they're trying to uncover an error, when they're trying to find and fix something that's broken, most of it's being used there. But the reality is that telemetry data has incredible value across the entire lifecycle. And the research is showing that. So more than 80% of the folks that were surveyed are saying it is important across the entire stage of the lifecycle, right? But we are seeing a skew still towards the run or operate phase as people still figure out how to leverage that telemetry data across the entire software lifecycle.
Buddy, what are some of the lessons that listeners could take away from the report? Or, you know, if I'm putting myself in a VP of engineering or anyone on the engineering team's perspective, what are the actions I could do if I consume the information of the report?
I think there are two dimensions that are really key that are our actions to take. And Greg described the first one, which is getting utility out of all of this telemetry in places other than just using it when the software is on fire, right? Like, how about using it when the software is not on fire? How about doing your sprint planning, taking a look at the most common errors that are happening in the system and prioritizing those in order to raise the quality level of the software that's already in production as a means of avoiding technical debt? That's the first one, is being able to use the telemetry data that is an investment, right? Because it is an economic investment that people are making, whether you use a commercial provider like New Relic or others who do this, you know, as a commercial service, or you're using open source software and you're storing it in places that you're paying for and you're maintaining it with people that cost money. It is an investment that you're making. And so getting value out of that investment in other phases besides just when the software is on fire is one key thing, one key takeaway. Another one is that software still has a lot of dark areas that are not being observed at all. And it's just unknown what's happening in there. And in today's landscape with software architectures, you can't predict anymore where those problems are going to happen. And so you can't just sample certain parts of your architecture because you know that's where the problems are going to lie. That was something that perhaps was possible to get away with prior to the shift away from monoliths and toward microservices, but it's not possible anymore. And people who operate software, companies whose business relies on software, which is substantially everyone, it seems these days, are paying the price for it. And of course, ultimately, those end users who are just trying to do something with software, right? They're trying to, you know, communicate with their child's teacher or share a photo with a loved one or something like that, right? Or learn something, they're paying the price. And so being able to observe everything that's happening in the software is really key. And one of the other things that we found is that, and Greg touched on this, that 80% of executives plan to increase their budget for observability in the next year, 20% expect to increase it significantly. And that's because there's been this kind of 1-2 punch that's driven urgency around getting a handle on observability. The first one was that even before the COVID pandemic, software had gotten really hard to manage and keep running because of the decomposition of monoliths into all these microservices. It affords a great deal of agility to software developers to be able to move fast, but it also adds a burden in the trade-off of having to reason about and manage all of these different pieces of software. So that was already hard. Then the pandemic happened and drove everyone home, and it drove the stakes up an order of magnitude because the expectations for that software to work ratcheted up tremendously. And so I think we see that reflected in the report. But if there are two different dimensions that people could focus on that would drive, I think, the maximum value out of people's investment in observability, number one would be using it throughout the entire life cycle, not just in the operate phase and not just when software's on fire, number one. And number two, to figure out where those dark spots are and get some instrumentation on that. When we're talking to customers about their software and the places that aren't being instrumented about New Relic, sometimes they're instrumenting it with other observability providers, but more often they're not observing it at all. There's just no telemetry. Yeah. And so getting that going, and it's one of the reasons why we're embracing things like open standards, because I think a lot of the work that the CNCF and Open Telemetry are doing are going to make it a lot easier for operators of software to act in telemetry installed in the first place. This is another problem that people have, I think, is that they're developing software so fast that they can't instrument fast enough to keep up with the pace of software development.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I can see that budgets are going here. I can see that with our LinearB customer base. And the other thing that I can see is that a lot of the times for most companies, maybe this is the first time that they are getting observability. Again, we're so focused on that coding to release and a little bit into production. And a lot of our customers, this is the first time that they're ever getting visibility. And we're offering some best practices. What do you do if you see that code is getting stuck in a PR process, or how can you help your developers? I was wondering if there's any best practices that came out of the report, or some of the common things that our audience should be listening to and doing.
I think one of them that I can share, and then I'll turn it over to Buddy, is this idea. You know, we talk a bit about these data silos, right? And we're obviously getting more of that data in so you don't have those blind spots that Buddy mentioned. But when you do, trying to bring it all into a single platform, because the reality is, if all of that data is spread across different tools, different platforms, et cetera, you're wasting a lot of engineer toil and time to try and make sense of that data versus bringing it all into a single platform so that you are being able to get past sort of what is there to understand the why, so that you can really address problems or challenges and really deliver great software and great experiences. So for me, one of those big ahas and best practices was the folks that responded to the survey who are consolidating their monitoring tools and their APM and their observability into a single platform so that they're immediately getting past the challenges of the data silos that happen if you don't do that.
Got it. Totally makes sense. Buddy, anything to add on to that for some of the best practices?
Yeah, just that, you know, when we looked at the report, the number of different tools that people use to manage their software is pretty big. You know, I mean, like there's never going to be a single tool that everyone uses to do everything throughout the entire software lifecycle. But there don't have to be over 10 of them necessarily, on the other hand. And a third of the respondents use more than six tools just for observability, right? And so there is a big opportunity to bring everything together in one place. Like Greg said, you know, one of the things that we're working hard on at New Relic is providing the ability to see everything that's happening across their full stack in a single place, in a single tool. The other thing, though, that we're working hard on, and this is my focus at New Relic, is for the tools elsewhere in the software developer lifecycle that you use for things like issue tracking and continuous integration and, you know, collaboration tools and all the rest, that we are connecting in to all of those different tools to reduce that swivel chair problem that engineers have.
Yeah, that sounds great. I mean, I would agree with you. There's so many tools out there that can provide visibility, transparency, observability. And anytime that you can get it more so in a single pane of glass, I think it's advantageous for productivity. I wanted to ask you both, some of the pieces of data that I saw in the report, it kind of went with my intuition. Is observability mission critical at this point? Like, yeah, it's mission critical. It's really hard to understand what's going on in software development organizations, microservice architectures, production is getting crazier and crazier. That made sense to me. Was there anything that jumped out where it was like the data did not match your intuition in the report?
Yeah, for me, obviously, the number of tools to me is astounding, right? Having to use 6, 10 tools, that sort of thing. The other thing that jumped out to me is where we're at as an industry with Kubernetes and containers, right? My expectation would have been that far more of the respondents would have already been in production than 10%. Now, 40% expect to be in production within a number of years. But to me, that number was far lower than I would have expected for actual in production for using Kubernetes and containers and really those things becoming the norm.
Buddy, anything to add on to that?
Yeah, I think there were a couple. Number one, this is of course reassuring to me, both because I work at New Relic and also because, like I said, I've been doing this type of stuff for essentially my entire professional life, was that 90% said they thought observability was both important and strategic to their business. I thought it would be a lot, but I didn't think it would be 90%. That percentage was higher than I would have expected. I wonder how much of that is driven by the urgency of the pandemic, like I said, and the fact that people rely on software more than they ever have before. That number to me was, I thought it would be the majority, of course, you know, maybe somewhere 75, 80%, but 90% was higher than I expected. The other thing that I thought was interesting about it, I don't know how surprising it was, but something that I could have seen gone either way, was the commentary around open source and whether the perception of the 1,300 respondents would be that they liked open source because of the perceived economics of it, the fact that you can download it, install it, and go, or if it would be actually the capabilities and the fact that the most innovative, kind of capable, best place to go to for software would be the open source community. And it was the latter. They said that the top reason for adopting open source software was to take advantage of the latest innovations. That was interesting to me that that was their top reason. And it's also the reason why, like I said, we're, you know, New Relic over the last year in particular has been embracing open source, in particular telemetry and things like OTel, because we do believe it's the future.
Yeah, we had the, well, to respond to both, I mean, we had the Kubernetes founder on the pod. And yeah, I mean, that community has obviously exploded. I'm sure you're going to see more and more of that into production as time goes on. And then most engineering organizations, you know, probably want that latest and greatest cutting edge stuff. You can get that, I think, more quickly or accessibly in open source. So that's super interesting. Really awesome conversation. Is there any kind of like final takeaway you'd want our audience to understand from your finding?
I think for me, it would be to, as you read through the report, if you download it, and as you think about observability, don't just think about it as a technical problem. Think about it as an organizational problem. Think about how you get all of the different groups within your company to collaborate and interact in service of creating better software for your customers in the same way that those services have to interact and work together. Because if your teams can't collaborate and interact, then the software won't collaborate and interact. The software that you use as a consequence of that to get a handle on what's happening in your software, the observability tools that you use have to be able to support that as well.
Yeah, for me, it's just the thought of how can we leverage as much of our telemetry data as possible with as many of our engineers as possible across as much of the software lifecycle as possible and not sort of stay with the restrictions of what we've always done so that we can truly develop the next generation of industry-leading experiences and software and that sort of thing. So just expanding that mindset around what data we tap into, who has availability to that data, et cetera.
Awesome. Well, Buddy and Greg, thank you so much for coming on here. Buddy telling some great engineering stories, and then the two of you keeping us up to date on what's going on in observability. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much for having us, Dan.
Thanks, Sam. It's our pleasure.
We'll include the link to the observability report in the description below. Also, be sure to join the Dev Interrupted Discord community where we keep this type of conversation going all week long. And remember, if you haven't already rated and reviewed the show on your podcasting app of choice, it'd help us out a lot if you did. So please do that.